bit of warning. The title slide here, this is a grindhouse talk. There are two talks in one. This is the first half, and then you get the second half. Both of which are done with the same set of co-authors over the last year and a quarter or so. Following up on some basic work I did about a dozen years ago, back when search engines seemed like a really new nifty thing. I was at Digital Equipment Corporation, we were working on AltaVista, and discovered, much to our surprise, as soon as we started turning the results back, that often you get such results that were almost indistinguishable from one another. And you know, you were looking for Unix manual page or something, and you get back 10 answers, all not quite the same as one another. Exactly the same, you know how to deal with that. That's what checksums are good at preventing, but slightly different. Checksums aren't very good at preventing that, or they didn't seem to be at the time. In particular, we wind up often with 10 pages, all of which were the Solaris man page, Solaris version of the man page, because when you run up a man page through Catman, it sticks the date ran Catman at the bottom of the page and the institution at which you generated at the top. And so the pages were all imperceptibly, unless you actually looked at the headers and footers, different from one another. This was bad. So we wanted the technique to find something that would efficiently solve that problem, get rid of the near duplicates. And at the time, we thought we were working on a huge data set because the AltaVista collection was, gosh, I don't know, 30 million pages at the time. And that's where I left it, more or less, a dozen years ago. Our near duplicate expression stuff worked just fine. Then I went to Microsoft after Digital vanished from the face of the earth a few years ago. Lo and behold, Microsoft decided about a year after I got there that they wanted to build a search engine of their own. And I was explaining that this would be a problem they would run into, and they actually wanted me to do something else for them, so I was working on the other part of their search engine, helping them out a little bit. But then, about 4 months later, when they first started getting results back, they started saying, oh my god, we have a problem with your duplicates. And so I started thinking about the problem again, anew. And now the scale of the problem has gotten even bigger. Search engines these days are up in the 20 billion page range. 20 billion squared is an uselessly large number. You can't hope to do all pairs to look for duplication. Let me describe an algorithm we have that runs, that's approximate, probabilistic. It runs in time roughly linear in the size of your data set, which is a good thing. And most of the work is in pre-processing. And that's what min hashing allows to do. So, as I said, I've been working on trying to make min hashing faster a few times over the years, mostly 10 to 12 years ago, and then more recently when Microsoft decided to mount its own search efforts over the last 3 or 4 years. And so the idea of min hashing is it's a technique for sampling. Sampling is a good thing. We heard that in the last talk a little bit. Sampling from a stream uniformly, that's good because everything's equally likely to be picked, but consistently. And what that means is if the stream only changes a little bit, the samples will only change a little bit. And in particular, what we mean is the probability that the sample from document A or stream A and stream B are identical is equal to the Jaccard coefficient of the streams. So the cardinality of the intersection of the sets and divided by the cardinality of the union. A reasonable thing that people have used in IR for a while, it's kind of a scaled version of the L1 distance, roughly. You can imagine doing things like cosine similarity, which is more like a scaled version of L2, and is fully rotationally invariant, but that leads you down a different path. And this is the one we followed previously. Okay, so to get to view things using a Jaccard coefficient, we have to decide that we're going to view our documents, photos, music, whatever it is, our things, as a set of features. Right? So you're going to analyze each of your things independently, generate a set of features, and now we want to select from that set of features ones that we really like. For text documents, what we actually look at typically are the k-grams. Take, you know, 5 or 6 words in a row, and so look at all of those. So if you take all of those and you turn the document into a torus, wrap it around beginning to front, then the number of phrases is exactly equal to the length of the document in words, which is a good thing. Okay, so we want to be able to view the feature set as a vector in some immense dimensional space, you know, where the dimensionality is, you know, the number of words in the union of all natural languages or something like that. And we want to find vectors. When you have a vector, you want to find out what's nearby. Where by nearby, you mean nearby enough that a user, a human, probably won't be able to tell the difference. So if the document is very short, then you're able to discern the difference between that and another document pretty easily. If it's large, then you know a small edit distance isn't quite as interesting because the thing is huge. And so we want this idea of scaling is interesting. So we're looking at, experimentally, we determined the Jaccard coefficient of about 0.95 was about what people thought of as being identical. But that's, I don't do the semantic side stuff, so you can believe that or not as you wish. I don't care. Okay, and so we want to find those most of the time. And if we look in L2 instead of this L1 thing, then instead of Jaccard, you want with cosine similarity, so do those, take those same vectors and now look at the angle between them. And so we want things that are more, that are pretty well aligned in this immense dimensional space. And then Indic and Matwani, about a year after we did our stuff, said, okay, well in that case, to boil it down, the simplest way to think of it is take a random rotation of your high dimensional space. And now drop all but the first 100 coefficients of your of all of your vectors. And now, in fact, in your vector, just remember the sign, whether it's positive or negative, after this random rotation. And now look for vectors that then can prove that the count of the number of bits where they agree is well correlated with the angle. And so that's what they did. And that led them to decide, after also having seen our stuff, that there was a more general thing than what we had come up with, which is the idea of locality sense of hashing. And so they went off and at least some of them went off and helped Google do their min hashing, their version of duplicate suppression, rather, early on. And so they're much wealthier than I am. Okay, so let's go back to Jaccard. So again, the idea is we want to look at the size of the intersection compared to the size of the union of two things. And it worked out pretty well. And so the way we do this, more precisely, is you take roughly 100 such samples that are uniform but consistent, so that when you change the document a little bit, you still get more or less the same set of samples. And we do this by picking 100 random one-to-one functions mapping us to some well-ordered range. Doesn't matter what. we want one-to-one so we don't have to deal with collisions. At the end, that would just confuse things, change the probabilities in annoying ways. For each such function, look at, and given an input set A, which are just the features of the original stream or document or whatever you have, select the pre-image, the element of your input set, whose image under this random function is minimal in our well order. Right, there has to be a least. So pick the one that leads there, and naively you'd think that this would take 100 evaluations of random functions to do. And so what I'm going to tell you about now in this part of the talk is how to make it a little bit faster than that, considerably faster, about 30 times faster. So what we did 12 years ago, even, was we recognized we could speed this up by a factor of 8 without too much difficulty. And the way we did that at the time was pick a random 64-bit function, carve it into 8 8-bit slices, and treat that as those 8 bits as the leading 8 bits of 8 different random functions. And now minimizing using those 8 bits, only one time in 256 will you get something that's a winner, that's minimal. And so only then do you have to go on and generate the rest of your large random output. And so that means that the amount of randoms you have to generate, and that's where all the expense is here, is evaluating some pseudo-random function, some hash function, whatever you use to generate something that's kind of like random. You're spending a lot of time doing that, because for every single word in your document that generates a new phrase, you now have to run that 100 different functions over that. Well, that takes time. So that's how we made it faster a while ago. So, why does this give us the right answer, you might ask? Why does this approximate Jacquard? Well, this is actually fairly easy. If we assume a uniformly chosen random function mapping injectively to infinite binary sequences, that way we don't have to worry about collisions, certainly, and we order the sequences lexicographically, that satisfies our need to have a well ordering. Given sets A and B and a random function F, then the argmin, the thing that comes up smallest applying F, has to be an element of one or the other, right? If it's in the union, it came from one place or the other. And the probability that it came from the intersection, since this thing is a uniformly chosen random function, is exactly equal to the size of the intersection divided by the total population that it could have been drawn from, the size of the union. So that is Jacquard. And as I said before, and I'll say it again when we get to the second half of the talk, sampling, all that's required to get a sampling process, you don't care, this mechanism for choosing a sample isn't necessary, but what is necessary to get samples which have the right probability of agreeing are uniformity, everything has to be a candidate, and consistency, you can't change, once you pick something, you can't change your mind. If the set gets a little bit bigger, the thing you picked, anything that was already in the set, doesn't get better just because you add more stuff to the set, basically. Okay, so how do we do this? How do we make this more efficient? Well, if we generate 64 bits of randomness, and I'm throwing around these powers of two because actual computers tend to like to do things in integral units of bytes or words or whatever, so 64 happens to be a convenient number to imagine that we're using. So we're going to carve it into expected 32 pieces. And we're going to do that by dividing it up at, we have 64 random bits, zeros and ones. We're going to divide it up at the ones. So imagine they're just coin flips, right? Keep flipping until you flip ahead. And all we're going to remember is how many tails we flipped, so the number of zeros that we got to before we got to a one. And then we'll throw those bits away and move on to the next sample. And by doing this, we're going to get about 32 samples from our 64 bits. So we'll have to generate, three or four of these 64-bit things in order to generate our 100 samples. Because, it's a fair coin. Heads and tails are equally likely. And the number of sequences, the number of inputs that map to the same maximal length sequence of zeros is bounded by two, independent of how many terms there are in what we're doing. Now, having written as 10000, now it's hard to think of. We're actually reading from the end, so to get our lexicographically smallest. So you should think of that as a string of zeros, all the tails, and then the head. But in practice and implementation, it winds up being easier to represent it this way, which is why I've written it badly. And if we do this, this gives us something which runs about a factor of 4 faster than what we had before. So that's great. But it leaves us with a simple problem, very simple problem, which is In the old days, it's very easy to carve up a 64-bit number into 8 8-bit numbers, right? Computers actually have operations to help you do this. So how do we efficiently divide at the ones? Well, some processors claim to have instructions to find the rightmost one in a word. And some of them even work. But they actually tend not to work incredibly fast. Fortunately, we can figure out how to do this pretty well. So we could go a bit at a time, just look at the Lord a bit. If it's a zero, shift everything, keep trying. But that's going to be computationally inefficient, ugly, slow. Given that we're processing, billions and billions of things, each of which contains, tens of thousands of words, so that we're actually looking at, a quadrillion times we have to run this operation. Despite the budget that Google and Microsoft have to throw out the search problem, we can't actually afford anywhere close to a quadrillion computers yet. Okay, so we could look at the lower order byte, and if the whole byte is zero, then shift by a byte and repeat. If it's non-zero, then we could do a table lookup, say. We could pre-compute where the rightmost one is in a non-zero byte. And that would actually work just fine. So I should stop here, but I won't, because it's not mathematically beautiful. So now we're going to move into sort of a hack mem world. We're just going to see what kind of bit twiddling tricks can you do just for your own amusement, just because, just because you can. All right, so we can reduce the problem to a simpler problem. That's always a good thing to do, right? We're trying to find the rightmost one in an arbitrary word with all zeros and ones. Let's turn it into a simpler problem. Let's turn it into finding the rightmost one in a word which is a power of two. Sounds easier, right? Okay, so x anded with minus x, bit anded, it isolates the rightmost one in a word. It's been known for a long time, and if you don't believe it, you can actually read what's up there, you can test it for yourself. And unfortunately, in some of what's going to follow, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that the 2's complement arithmetic, tilde x plus 1, complement of x plus 1 is what gives us negative x, because in some languages you can't actually write minus x if x is an unsigned number. The compiler just gets unhappy, so we'll finesse that by remembering how to do 2's complement arithmetic. Okay, so we can reduce the set of all 64-bit numbers down to 65 possibilities, right? The ones that have a single one someplace in them, and then the all zero word. All right, well, so I thought about this and said to myself, well, that means it must be possible to find a very simple hash function, which we could apply to this word and find something, a hash function, a perfect hash function, no collisions. So that I could then just look up in a table to see which one I had, and that would run quickly. And so, naively, you could do something by your shift. You could do better if you had a perfect hash. And Peter Montgomery, I was sitting at lunch up in Redmond one day. Don't spend that much time up there, but I happened to be up there that day. Peter happened to be eating lunch. Pointed out to me that his guess was that 2 was a primitive root of unity, mod 67, right? Which means that 2 generates the multiplicative group, modulo 67, which means the powers of 2 mod 67 are all distinct, just looking at them as integers. And so that's what he said. So why don't you just do this x and minus x trick, reduced to a power of 2, and now take that mod 67 and do a table lookup to find which one you came from, where you started. And the nice thing about that is that even 0 comes up distinct, because the powers of 2 mod 67 can't be 0, because we're only generating the multiplicative group. So 0 happens to stay 0, and so that's even better. All right, so that's great. But then I got further annoyed. It's a perfect hash function, but it has a slow operator mod in it. It's not a minimal perfect hash function. How can we live with that? So fortunately, it turned out, looking around trying to figure out what else I could do here, that Leisen Prokop and Keith Randall, who is a colleague of mine back at Digital, had noticed that you can use De Bruijn sequences and do even better than this, which I felt chagrined not to know, it's a problem having been a logician rather than a combinatorist in my youth. I didn't know about De Bruijn sequences. So a De Bruijn sequence, you can think of it kind of like a gray code, in that it's a traversal of all the patterns, all the binary sequences. But the operation, rather than doing a flip on the hypercube of one bit at a time, you do a rotation. So I think of it, almost everyone remembers those candy necklaces you had as a kid, where you had a string of little sugary candies on an elastic band that would you'd wear on your neck and you'd eat them one by one. Well, at least I would eat them sequentially. Maybe you were less orderly about that process than I. And so a De Bruijn sequence would be an arrangement of the candies on this necklace in such a way that whatever sequence of, you know, five candies in a row you wanted to eat, there would be a starting point someplace on the necklace where you could start from there and eat counterclockwise around the necklace and eat exactly the candies you were interested in order, say. Okay, and there's an example up there of a De Bruijn sequence for three-bit binary strings, one such sequence. Any three-bit binary string you want occurs in there at some starting position if you, since this repeats at some point. So, okay. So, then random fact about De Bruijn sequences in case you're as ignorant as I was half a year ago. A rotation of a De Bruijn sequence is a De Bruijn sequence. That's obvious. The reversal of a De Bruijn sequence is still a De Bruijn sequence. Also fairly obvious. When people count them, they tend to rotate them so that the long string of zeros is the beginning. So you make it pick the lexicographic least rotation, and that gives you a canonical way of representing them. That for binary sequences of length 6, there happen to be exactly three such canonical sequences. One sequence and its reversal, and then one sequence which is its own reversal, which doesn't actually matter any, but they exist. Now rotation isn't something computers are happy to do, especially if you have a power of 2, but multiplication by a power of 2 is shifting. If we put the zeros at the beginning of our word and do shifting, well, if we put it in the higher bits of our word, the 6 higher bits are the part we're going to read out, then as we multiply by a power of 2, new things will shift into the higher bits, we'll get add some more zeros in, but only the first 58 shifts will never hit the part, the extra zeros, and the last 5 shifts will get these zeros from coming in because of the multiplication, but that's okay because we wanted 5 more zeros. Actually, we wanted 6 more zeros. So multiplication and rotation are the same in this case. And so it's very simple. This is the hex representation of one of the three De Bruijn sequences in question. And now we can just multiply by this and we're done. So, oops. And what's nice about this is the implementation is actually beautifully small and beautifully fast. Okay, and doesn't have lots of misbranch predicts and all sorts of stuff. So it's runs almost exactly the same speed as the fast hardware implementations do for finding the first one, and otherwise it's very nice. Okay, so that's the end of the first talk. So, about the same time I was starting to do that, some guys up in Redmond were asking me the following question. They were starting to look at how to do a better job of duplicate suppression and saying, well, you know, those guys over at Google, they're using this vector space representation. That means they can deal with multiplicity. So they don't, their vectors don't have to all be, you know, have coefficients of 0 or 1. They can actually keep track of how long the vector is in each dimension and take advantage of that and figure out whether things are similar. And so I told them, well, okay, we know how to do that too, but then you have to actually count how many times a phrase occurs within a document. That's annoying. But suppose you really want to do that. Anyway, so we know how to do that. But we can generalize, Jacquard a little bit too. Instead of having just the intersection and over the union, we say we have the min count over the max count for each phrase. And that gives us a generalization of Jacquard, which works just fine. And that corresponds to exactly what you would get if you took every instance, and if there were repeated copies, you replaced it by an indexed copy of the word. That gives you, mathematically comes out to exactly what you want. And so we figured this out 10 years ago or so, and so the problem was solved, I thought. And I just told them, okay, we know how to do multiplicity. You just have to repeat everything enough times, remember which instance you have, and then the sampling will work exactly the same way you want. But they didn't like that, because they wanted to have the application they had in mind. The multiplicity counts would be up in the tens or hundreds of thousands. And so the question was, could we do better? This is just background, the same stuff from the previous talk, don't care about that. Okay. And this is, again, just repeating things, who cares? So the previous technique would run linear in time equal to the input size. So if you had, you know, cat, and dog showing up in your document, line 4, if we expand it out to cat 1, cat 2, cat 3, dog 1, it's going to take time 4 to evaluate that. And they didn't like that. So I thought again, and this time I thought a little bit too fast, as you'll see in a moment, that we can use probability and help ourselves out here. We know the continuous distribution function that some random variable x is bigger than x is 1 minus x. That's easy. And so the probability that the smallest of k variables is bigger than x, well, that's 1 minus x to the k, isn't it? That's obvious. But that's correct. I mean, it's right, but it's not helpful. It gives you the uniformity you need, but it doesn't give you consistency. That is the sample you arrive at. If I go from having 100 cats to having 101 cats, then all the first 100 cats should stay exactly the same quality, right? Adding one more cat doesn't make cat 4 better than it used to be. Whereas just using that formula for what the probability is, the aggregate cat would have to get better, but where does that extra betterness go exactly is the question. So we want 100 cats and 200 cats to only be 50% similar. It has to be repeatable. If we pick cat number 7, if that's the best cat, if I have 100 cats, then I'm not allowed to pick cat 73 just because I have 200 cats. I have to pick a cat that's, you know, either cat 7 or cat 101 to 200. you might also want a sampling process to actually pick an instance that exists. But we might want to generalize this to allow real value weights rather than just integer counts. So we'll do that, but we have to have a sampling process which, in the case if the weights are integer, gives you the right answer restricted to integer answers. And we have picked uniformly, we have picked the same sample from any subset. So how do we do this? And how do we do this efficiently? So the first idea is let's break up the weights into, by looking at the power of two range in which the weight falls. So going all the way down to zero, so we have, you know, two to the negative values for possible weights as well. And the idea is that if we want to pick uniformly in the range from, say, 0 to 2, the probability of the sample between 1 and 2 and the probability between 0 and 1 has to be the same. That's forced on us. And so in each power of 2 range, the probability that there's a best in that range has to be a half. And in fact, once you pick something in that range, if I have 3.724 cats, then I can tell you what the probability that I get something in this range as opposed to something down here is the length of this interval, so 1.7 whatever, and then the total sum is 3.7 whatever, so the probability of picking a sample in there has to be proportional to that in order to get the uniformity that we need. And so the idea is fairly straightforward. Starting from a power of 2, you pick a random number smaller than that power of 2. Uniformly. If it's below the halfway point, stop. Hand the job over to the range below you, because that recursive call is what's going to allow us to do this in linear time, constant time, rather, whenever we come in with any number, right? So half the time it will be in this interval, half the time it won't be, but only half the time, and so we're in okay shape. Having picked that number, we now pick a uniform number in the range from there down. And again, if it's below the midpoint, stop. You found all the midpoints that you care about in this range. Otherwise, continue decreasing. The expected number of such things is small. The number of things we'll find in a range is bounded by 2. Because, 50% we have anything at all, it's bounded by 1, I guess. 50% we'll have anything at all, and once we have something, the interval is smaller than half the remaining size, the total size, so the probability of finding a second one is even a little bit smaller. That's all fine. Okay, we can do the same thing to round up to find the next place where we change our mind as to which cat we'd selected. So we just look, so instead of starting from the power of 2 that your number, that your weight comes in at, go round up to the next power of 2, and then round up beyond that, and keep going until you find the first sample above you. And that tells you how many cats have to be considered overall. And the reason you care about this is that if cat 7 survives as the best cat all the way out to cat 1,000, then that means the random number associated with it had better be pretty darn small. And so what you care about, even if you only knew that you had 7 cats, you didn't know anything about the fact that you better know when it's going to change. You're going to change your mind, because that's going to tell you what quality of random number you need to have. And so that's so what we do when we get a weight and a word cat, this column is representing the word, say, cat or dog or whatever you have, you use this random process to find the next thing, the first thing below it, and also to find the first thing above it that would be a point at which you would change your mind. Then, having done that, that tells us how many things we need to have, and then we have to use a slightly ugly CDF. If we care about the integer case, we have to use the discrete version of it. If we care about the continuous case, the formula is a little bit easier to look at, just x to the n times 1 minus n log x. And that tells us what the given a number between 0 and 1, what we should use to decide how good a random number we're actually going to generate. So you pick in a consistent way, for a given word, column, whatever you want to think of it as, you pick that downward and upward sequence, find the ones that bracket your weight. The sample you're going to pick, if you wind up picking this column, is the one below you, because it has to be smaller than where you started from. The weight you plug into the CDF is the sample above you, because that gives you the right probability of picking things. To make this more efficient, we do all sorts of clever tricks, sneaky tricks. For example, we don't actually fully evaluate this until we need to. We do the same sort of trick of using power of two ranges and say, well, is there any sample in this power of two range? If the answer is no, then we know that the quality is only so good, and so we can use that to see if we plug that into the CDF whether you have a winner or not. And if you can't possibly win in that range, then you don't need to evaluate any further. You take the logarithms of the CDF rather than the CDF itself because we're looking for values which are, you know, really tiny. And so we get a little bit more numerical accuracy looking at that instead. We don't actually converge the CDF to do inversions. We look at, plug the old best value into the new CDF and see if where we end up is better or worse than where we're trying to get to, so we don't actually have to do all the numerical inversions. And things like that. So, I think I followed the one important rule of these things when you're proceeding food is don't end late.